You know, a couple of weeks ago on this program, gentlemen, Mr. Jacques Barzan of Columbia University referred to a jukebox as a kind of mechanical hymnal. He thought that the jukebox represented for 20th century youth had some of the religious quality and, devotional value that the old hymnals used to have in the 19th century when people were simpler and nicer and more moral.
Think there's anything this is a program we call Conversation. It's dedicated to the art of good talk. Clifton Fadiman is our host. His guests tonight are Mitch Miller of Columbia Records, Alec Wilder, composer, and Howie Richman, music publisher. This transcribed conversation started several minutes ago, and as we turn up our microphones, our conversationalists are discussing what the wild jukebox is saying. Clifton Fadiman is speaking.
Ignorant and inimical to the darn stuff. I expect to be converted during the next half hour or so. Now tell me, what is the attraction of these devotional pop songs that you talk about, Mr. Wilder?
Well, I don't want to say anything against a fellow writer. I don't quite understand it, except that it seems to be to have a place in the sun right now. There are phases in popular music, and this seems to be one of them. It may have something to do with a tendency toward a religious revival in other fields, in religion itself.
Well, there is such a revival in other fields. I'll buy that. That's true. I now ask whether the youngsters who are listening to these curious, distorted hymns get anything out of it that they don't get out of an ordinary pop tune. Mitch, what do you think?
Kip, the youngsters get everything out of a jukebox. Remember, while they're having a hymn in there, they have a shaboom and an oop shoop, and they also have a hey there.
Wait. What are these first two things?
Well,
a boom and an oop shoop?
There were two songs that were big hits. One is called Shaboom, another one is Oop Shoop. And if you have any children around 13 to 17 or 18, you probably have been plagued by this.
I'm lucky.
Since I'm in the record business, I wish I had the good luck to have made both these songs, but I didn't have that good luck. But they say, so since you're in the record business, why does this generation go for that slop? And
well, very well. I'm going to ask that question. Why does this generation go for that slop?
All right. What about your generation? What's so great about Barney Google with his Google googly eyes, or horses, crazy over horses?
Well, now, for
horses.
One thing, you can remember Barney Google. It's got a darn good tune, still has a good tune.
But it's just
the melodies of most of these songs that you refer to seem to me impossible to keep in mind.
Well, it's a song that isn't either melody or lyric. It's a combination, and no song was ever sold solely on lyric or solely on melody. And if these sports, as I'll call them, happen to make it, that isn't the whole picture of the music business.
I want to hear from Mr. Richman, who is a publisher of these songs and probably knows an awful lot about them from the business point of view. Why do the kids go for them?
Well, it's a little difficult for me to try to tie in one single line of thought some of the ideas that have come across here. I think there are some interesting angles to a conversation.
Choose any one.
But it would seem to me that the one thing about songs today, primarily through the jukebox, that is a fairly clear-cut idea, is that when kids and when people go into the locations where jukeboxes are, such as drugstores and taverns and things.
Where aren't they, by the way?
Well,
practically anywhere.
Bowling alleys, they're just about every place. The music is a kind of background. It's a background of a time. The kids aren't really there primarily for the music. The first element to me in a novelty tune is something which is quickly contagious. When we hear tunes that have a little repetitious melody in it, the kind that you call slop, and I can't put a value judgment to them personally, maybe they are in a sense, but actually they're a little repetitious jingles, similar to nursery rhymes. Uh-huh. And they're in the background of the arena in which the kids are working and playing.
Well, are those the ones that really get into the big money? The kind you're talking of. Those are not the ones that really go big, are they, Mitch?
No, well,
isn't it the sentimental ballad on the whole?
No,
something with heart appeal?
No, there's room for every kind of song all the time, Kip.
Well, I mean the really big ones. Now, for instance, what's going big at the
moment? Well, the biggest record, there are two records that are going to be the biggest records of the year. One of them is Hey There, which is a show tune and a very much what we call a class song. And the other side is This Old House. Now, This Old House is a sort of a spiritual in the sense
no,
if you
I
listen
know that
to
one.
Well, the man is dying.
No.
But he lived a good full life, and he said he's getting ready to meet the saints. Now, kids are taught that whenever they go to Sunday school. Now, and then there's the other record that is on its way to 2 million. It's called Let Me Go Lover, with this little girl, the first record that she ever made. Now, you talked about melody before, selling a song. Now, this song had a melody, the same melody once. It was called Let Me Go Devil. What makes a hit song or a hit record is the self-identification that the listener has with that record. Now, with all the free plays that you get on the radio and in the jukebox, why do these people still go in the store to buy it? No one drags you by the ear and says, buy this record.
No.
They must mean that they want to play it 50 or 100 times at least at home when they want to hear it. I'll tell you what the self-identification is. Yeah. And it's the same thing in two other hit songs. This year. The Kitty Callan, what was it?
Little Things Mean a Lot.
And another one called If I Give My Heart to You. And that's the identification of the women in this generation. By that, they're economically, they're in competition with us. But when they become women, they're not treated completely as women by the men. By that, I mean there may be not enough hours of the day to be romantic, but every one of these songs is sort of asking for understanding from the man, not pleading for it. I love you, but please don't treat me so stinkily.
In other words, they really take the messages of these songs with genuine seriousness.
Yes, it's just because it happens to be in sort of basic English, shouldn't be held against it.
No. I'm trying to find out. Well, I'm not trying to be superior about
it. May I ask a question?
Sure.
In other words, the popular music of today a kind of a pedestrian philosophy? Is it a kind of a white-collar attempt to arrive at some philosophical concept?
You mean these are the ideas of the folks put in melody?
Yes. Well, it always was. But now I think now with the different communications and the different... you have your radio, you have the electronics revolution, you have phonographs in people's homes. Now, I went to school with Alec. At that time... if a record sold 50,000, it was considered a great hit. Well, who were the big people? As you remember, there was we were Crosby fans, we were Armstrong fans, Mildred Bailey, and Duke Ellington. Well, I guarantee you that none of those people ever lost any of those original fans.
What I want to find out is why this particular kind of pop music, and this brings up what Mr. Weiler was saying, why it's believed in when obviously its sentiment is false.
I'm quite anxious to get in a word here because
I've
got a feeling that we're kind of overgeneralizing and oversimplifying, rather, the whole point. Now, economically, after I'm a music publisher, and we worry about our sources of starting a song. Today, the primary source of starting a song is the record. There is no question about it. The radio and the television sponsors do not play songs that are new, generally speaking.
Well, isn't it true the television sometimes will make a hit out of a new song that appears on a show? Like this one, Let Me Go, Love.
Well, now that's Mitch. Mitch did that. He pioneered something. But actually, the majority of songs played on television, and I can vouch for this over at ASCAP and BMI, are about 95%. Either hit parade tunes, which are already there, or the standards.
It's the record, then, that makes it.
Now, this is our primary outlet, is the record, to get songs started. And we can't really go to Frank Sinatra or Dinah Shaw or Perry Como or Frankie Lane or the big stars and get our songs started unless they start on records. Now, this is the business that Mitch and some of the other boys, the other record companies, are actively creating in. Now, they want to sell records. That's their job. And I think Mitch knows probably more about music than most of us forget. But I don't want to give him any undue credit because this is his basic ability. However, in running his job, I think he's trying to sell records in as best taste as he can under the circumstances. Now, most of these records go to jukeboxes, and they go to disc jockeys and to kids. This is the audience. It's not the audience sitting at home listening to, for the sake of argument, a top artist singing in their living room. Eventually, the songs get there. And when they get there, they sure sound a little bit different than if they'd started there. Mitch picked up a song that Jane Froman introduced called I Believe, which she'd been singing as a theme song.
I know that
and,
one
very she
well.
And he made a record with Frankie Lane that went into the jukeboxes. Now, I was fortunate enough to publish it. I will tell you that many of the original people who heard Jane Froman's record thought Frankie Lane's record was sacrilege because it was exciting, it moved. Yet Frankie Lane sold well over $1 million, $1.5 million, and Jane Froman didn't get off the ground. Now, the point is that Mitch knew what he was doing in order to sell records, and also he made that song much more available to the general public through the jukebox, through the disc jockey. But we're not primarily promoting our songs through the major markets of radio and television at the start. And by the way, we come on another subject at the same time, the Broadway show. The majority of long-range standards that we know started either in shows or in films because they didn't have to make it in 30 days.
But aren't those in general superior to the jukebox product?
Not especially.
You don't think so? I'm thinking maybe.
Used to be.
No, well,
you think so, Mr.?
I think they used to be. I think that the tendency nowadays is for the writer of show music to... I think his standards have been lowered, I think a lot of pop writers have gotten into writing show music. And I don't think that the present-day show writer would have been allowed in town 15 years ago.
You're thinking of the average one, not somebody like
Well, no, the successful
Rodgers
shows. No, they're the keepers of the keys.
Could we just make a little general statement, see if it fit? The more you hear the classic or the standard type song that we're speaking of, such as the show tune, the more you like it. And the more you hear the pop tune, the less you like it, beginning at some point after 90 days.
That's very interesting.
Now,
in other words, it's a quick sale, zooms right up to a peak, and then is forgotten.
But at the same time, if you make a record of a song like Tenderly, I think that's come pretty close to 800,000 or 900,000. He just made a tune of Alex that'll live as long as any of us do.
What's the name of that?
While We're Young, which is, to me, not a minor classic, but a true classic of pop music. Because 20 years from now, it'll have new meaning for new generations. But at the same time, the pop kids, the kids who are running down the street to buy records, would much more likely run in to buy Bacha Me.
Tell me, how does a publisher and a record maker like yourself, Mr. Richmond, you, Mitch, how do you guess the trend?
That's a $64 question. Some of us get luckier than others at a period of time. I think the big project is being up at bat, being able to take chances. Now, there's a recent fad that's taken place in the last 90 days towards mambo music. Now, I must admit that I have guessed wrong on the mambo influence in pop music.
Give me a little, fill me in on mambo music, will you? You know, this stuff is new to me.
Well,
I'm not dealing with analphabetic in pop music.
I think we'd have to pass the deal to Mitch on the mambo because I don't know, truthfully, what its recent origins in the pop music field are. However, it's something new. There's a new rhythm. Isn't that right, Mitch?
Well, it started in Cuba about 18, 20 years ago.
Well, what's the difference between mambo and the ordinary Cuban rhythms that we are familiar with?
Well, just the beat behind it. And the different step, but basically the Latin music is all the same.
It isn't any different then from the samba.
It is different.
It is,
but it isn't. Now
that's clear. But now I want to know about trends. You say you missed out on figuring the mambo trend.
Well, I'd like to put it this way: we didn't think of it first. It came along, and it apparently got very, very exciting on a few records about 3 months ago. It got to such a point, apparently, that some of the fellas knew how far this trend had gone. Matter of fact, Mitch made a record with Clooney again. We keep bringing her up, but she's one of the top artists on a thing called Mambo Italiano, which I think is a very cute record. I think Mitch, at some point, decided that this was a craze. He could make a record that he could get out within the 30 days necessary, and he did, and he's probably sold a million. Now, even Woody Herman, who is, as far as I'm concerned, the most wonderful jazz band that I've ever heard, had a great standard called Woodchopper. Now, that's 15 years old, if it's a day. He did it over again as a mambo, and he sold another couple of 100,000 records.
Just now, hooking onto the trend.
Hooking onto the trend. Now, our philosophy over at our publishing office is that maybe if we had thought of it, assuming that we had known about the possibility in the sense of a mambo rhythm, we might have gone ahead and tried to pioneer it. Now, to get on the bandwagon, frankly, in popular music, I think you've got 60 or 90 days and you're just about out. Now, that may be six months.
That's quick stuff.
So that we would much prefer taking our songs where they come from and looking for our own approach. Now, that comes up to Alec, you see.
I was going to ask Alec. Alec's a composer. Do you have any feeling when you sit down to write a song that you're writing it in a trend that's going to hit the
public
favor?
Well, that's my trouble.
Or do you just write what you
darn please? I'm only interested in writing good songs, and I've tried writing material and songs that met a market.
Yeah.
And I find that it's not, as far as I'm concerned, a sincere endeavor. I mean, I don't completely believe it. So that I'm really out of the contemporary picture in terms of trends, because I can only write well what I feel and believe in.
Okay, I honor that. But you would never, for example, take a well-meant suggestion from two experts like Mitch here and Howie, who know the market, think they know the market at any rate, would you ever listen to them if they told you to write such and such?
Oh, I've tried many times, and they don't very often work because of...
But how about your colleagues? Don't they often write to a predetermined market?
The successful writers are writing constantly and constantly taking the pulse. As a matter of fact, I've met a boy recently who is, as far as I can make out, quite talented and has been quite successful, although he jumped into the business right from college and decided that he was going to try to make it. While very intelligent, he has made this point of ambition to achieve a certain roster of popular songs, and he's been able to write to a demand, to a market. At the same time, he's kept enough integrity, or perspective, rather, to be able to write just a song.
Well, what you're saying, though, is that there is such a thing as an observable, checkable market for which you can write.
I believe so.
Tricks.
Yes, indeed.
Yes,
is that right,
but,
Mitch? Bob Merrill is a great instance of an illustration
of that. That's right, but there's another thing that everyone forgets, and that is there's always room for any type of song that hits home to the emotions of the listener.
Isn't it true that the sudden triumph of a new performer, let's say Johnny Ray a year or two ago, will start a Johnny Ray trend?
Yes.
Ray-type songs on the whole?
Well, yes, because he made it acceptable to be very, very extrovert on a record, on this particular record of Cry. But if you stop and think, the song Cry says to... If your sweetheart sends a letter of goodbye, or if you have troubles, it's no sin to just sit down and have yourself a good cry. Now, how is that any different than what Rabbi Liebman told you to do in Peace of Mind? He said that the people who, when they had a bereavement in the family, those that had some sadness, those that sat down and cried were able to express themselves more emotionally later instead of going to the analyst house 2 years
ago. Okay. Had that particular emotion or idea ever been expressed in pop music before?
Oh, yes. Not an example, but the idea of crying had.
It had.
Sure, but not in this way.
I can remember laugh songs, but I can't remember cry songs.
Oh, crying myself to sleep. Don't you remember?
That's not the same thing as what Johnny Ray is telling you to do,
but
exactly.
The timing of this Johnny Ray record was very important. That's one thing that we haven't talked about, and that is something you can't divine, because you've seen shows come into New York, and you thought that the show wasn't particularly good, but it came at a time when there was a need for a show. I don't think I'm hurting Can-Can by saying that it had bad reviews, and it wasn't particularly good. But there was a need for that type of show, the idea of the whole idea of the French kick with Moulin Rouge and Can-Can and the kicking legs and all that. And there was nothing in New York at the time. And they went on, and now they're an established hit for over a year and a half. Well, it's the same with songs. Johnny Ray came in with Cry at the height of the Korean business. Kids were in school. They didn't know when they got out of high school whether they'd
go
to college.
You really think there was a tie-up between
absolutely. I looked for that all the time.
And can you determine that? Can you feel it? To me, the tie-up between the general feeling of a whole country in connection with the Korean War and a song such as Cry seems such a tenuous connection.
Not at all, because the kids at school could make no plans for the future. They were stymied. Well, what else can they do? They say, well, if you cry, at least it's something.
You know, I'm so glad to have you say this, Mitch, because it makes something clear to me. And that is that these songs apparently are real.
Oh, yes.
They are not confections. They actually mean something to the youngsters.
I guarantee you that if you have any friends who have children who were from the age of 14 or 17 when Cry came out, they will tell you that they locked themselves, closed the door, put themselves in a room, probably played the record many, many
times. Very interesting.
I have another theory, if you don't mind.
No, no, go ahead. This is the
place. On the rhythm and blues, on these so-called nonsense things. After every war, every crisis in the world, we've had the idea of the rebellion of the kids.
Yes.
Nonconformity. When I was a kid, I remember after World War I, we wore sailor pants and shoestring ties. Mm-hmm. And we used to wear the gaiters, you know, with them open and flapping.
So you haven't changed looking at that beard of
yours. Well, so that was our way of rebellion. See, now... with these songs, these nonsense songs, and these rhythm and blues songs, I think this is the way the kids are being nonconformist. And I think it's very healthy that they do it this way instead of running off and slitting somebody's throat. They do it in a mob. They feel that they're defying convention. They get rid of their aggressions this way, and then they come home and hang out
growing. Full of tricky theories, this Miller. It's wonderful.
After showing about 10 or 12 tunes to a fellow like Mitch, a publisher starts to think in terms of the things that he knows the record men are looking for their artists. You'd be surprised, at least I think I am, when I think that Mitch has a certain image of Frankie Lane.
Yeah.
We hear a song over in a publishing office, and very frequently a writer writes a song for a singer. And we say, Frankie Lane or Perry Como, oh, they can sing this, it'd be wonderful. Eddie Fisher would be fine on this. But when you come to the artist and repertoire man, the guy who decides who's going to sing what...
That's Mr. Miller.
Mr. Miller has a whole casting system. He sees Frankie Lane as a personal individual, relating on an individual level to certain ways. There are certain things he can or cannot say better than others, let me say. I don't think he's got a closed mind about his character.
I mean, he casts these songs just the way a casting director in the theater would.
I'm afraid that would be absolutely right, although he does often see his artists as repertoire artists, capable of doing a number of different things.
Tell me about country songs. I want to know about that. Now, this is the sort of stuff I used to like very much about 10, 12, 15 years ago. Now it seems to me repetitious. It all sounds...
You like country songs, then?
Well, I call it hillbilly stuff, but country songs.
May I ask you? May I be a moderator and ask you why?
Yeah, it had a faint trace of honesty.
Good. Very good. That's the basic element.
I think that's its prime asset.
Yes.
Real communication on the simplest of levels.
But that was true 15 years ago, maybe. It seems pretty synthetic to me now. I listen to a lot of it on the radio.
You don't have that need for that honest song anymore.
Miller is so clever.
I know.
Yeah,
for years.
I'm not going to raise any more objections because he just sweeps them out of your path. Well, tell me, why is country song stuff so popular in the East? It is, isn't it? Very popular.
I would say up until about 6 months ago, it was pretty much the primary source of at least half of the pop hits on recordings.
I would think so, too. How do you account for it?
There was a fellow down in Tennessee, Hank Williams, who has recently died. Hank Williams never studied or did anything about either his English grammar or his music, yet he was able to communicate certain words in many songs, which had universal, at least pop appeal, and when done by the popular artists rather than the country artists, and they were successful country hits first, they swept the country. There was a vogue of them, which is on the decline right now, and without trying to get too technical, I think what's happened down in the country field is that those fellows who are writing straight from their heart have been figuring, can they get a record by Rosemary Clooney or Dinah Shore or Perry Como, and they have become city fellas. And whereas to a true composer, such as Alec, for example, who has to hesitate before he samples the market, he's got to write what he can write best and what he feels, and he can't... he does discipline himself, no doubt, in hearing music and thinking, but he's going to write as he knows with his background, his schooling, and his basic abilities. And no matter how he tries to compromise and is willing to, he still will write what's in there. The professional writer...
He's stuck with his own honesty.
Yes, well, most of our professional writers...
And his own ability, too.
Yes, his own ability, that's the point.
I didn't want to mention.
Professional writers can cover up in many degrees for their ability. I mean, they're pros. I use the word with no sense of limitation. They're very capable craftsmen. But they're starting with the market, they're starting with the artist, they're starting with the trends. And may I say this, that a lot of writers today are not inhibited... because of good taste. They're not inhibited because of what's gone before. Some people know that there were songs such as some of the great standards that Irving Berlin has written, Cole Porter, many others. They would never write that same title. They would invariably stay away from the subject matter in the song, and certainly the melody lines they would consider to be prototypes, and they'd want to create something. Whereas our country writers... the boys who write from their heart, they just whistle, and a little bit's a little Cole Porter or something else that's been passed on through folk song down the line. They can't help it. It comes out that way, and it just happens.
Of course, the old ballad makers did the same thing. The anonymous ones stole from each other all the time.
But isn't there one thing, Kip, that with these basic songs, that like Marian Anderson is a great artist, yet when she sings Water Boy or any other spiritual, it's beautiful, but it's like under glass. It's refined.
That is correct.
But then you hear Mahalia Jackson.
That's correct,
who is singing from, really from her guts, mm-hmm. and singing the same song.
I'll buy that.
Well, so that's the difference between a trained composer and one who isn't trained. They're doing it to their best of their ability, the untrained one. Now, for a trained composer to try to write that same kind of song, he has to sort of relax.
Let me put it to Alec. Have you ever tried to write that kind of song?
Yes, indeed. But I haven't felt, I've worked from lyrics, and I've also worked from just from the tune itself. And somehow, well, let me put it this way. The only money I've ever made in my life is from songs that I wrote not for the purpose of making money.
Now, is it because you're a city boy, Alec, that you can't write this country song stuff?
No, I think it's...
Or is it because you have too much technique?
Well, I don't have that much, but I perhaps have a little too much. I believe in simple music, but if I can't write it, honestly, if the least contrivance gets into my mind that I am contriving... or I'm attempting to be simple. If I get self-conscious about it,
then you
it comes out somehow dishonestly. I don't know how.
It's true in writing, too. It's the only other art that I know anything about. It must be true in the pop music field. See, before we wrap up this subject, there's one mystery that you fellas have got to solve. I may never see you all together again to get the answer to this question from you. And I want you to explain Liberace to me.
Oh, dear.
I've listened to this distinguished gentleman. And had him on a show that I used to run, and he seems a very nice man indeed.
He plays the piano every bit as good as Oscar Levant. Now, if Levant has talent, so does he.
He plays as well as Oscar
Levant.
Yes,
he can, absolutely.
either of you other fellas got any ideas to why Liberace is what he is? The greatest success of his kind, probably, in history?
I must say, I can't answer the question directly, but occasionally I get on the road and run around the country trying to find songs and get them started. And
yeah.
I think I discovered for myself Liberace a little over a year ago, about 15 months ago, when I was in Nashville and later on in Dallas, Texas, where he had crowds that rivaled the annual Billy Graham festivals. And practically the same people, by the way, because I found out in Nashville that they were selling tickets on the same subscription lists for the big religious.
I'm sure that's true.
Now, I don't think
that
explains. I don't think it explains this very much about Liberace as far as his music is concerned. I would discount him, I'm afraid, even with my limited experience in criticism and evaluation of music, good or bad. I would say Liberace was not a musician. And I've watched him a couple of times, and I don't want to make any comments about whether how I felt exactly, but I did keep watching him. I didn't turn him off.
Well, I guess he's got something, and I think he's put it in the bank. I was thinking of that interesting statement you made about the connection between the Johnny Ray type of crying song and the way people were feeling at a specific moment about the Korean War. Now, that mm-hmm. I thought it over and made a great deal of sense to me. Do you see anything happening now?
Yes, in that sense.
In our contemporary history,
yes.
that might produce a kind of song which would match that mood.
More religious songs.
More religious songs.
It's what we call songs of faith, as it were, in the sense that it says it has no particular value for any particular sect.
Like I Believe.
Like I Believe.
Yeah. How about it, Howie? What would you say?
You've been listening to Conversation, a transcribed series of programs dedicated to the art of good talk. I'd love to.